in health in general, and that just happens to be the reason they made the films. We have no connection with the church. But the first film they made was called Run Dick, Run Jane. And it's a 23-minute color sound film that my husband did. And it's an introductory film for high schools, colleges, universities, etc., trying to motivate people into practicing preventive medicine through exercise. But I remember showing it in a high school one day, and I said, has anyone seen the film? And this one bright young man held up his hand, and he said, no, but I've read the book. But the second film is Coronary Counterattack, but I brought you the best of all three, What Makes Nellie Run. And it's a 17-minute color sound film, and I'm not necessarily the star of the film, and that's why I can say I think it's a good motivational film. There's some remarkable people, some of the people you will know, Kyle, that you've seen probably in the news, Tom Landry's wife's in it, and Kyle Roke Jr.'s wife's in the film, and Clint Murchison's wife, and several of the people who run in it around the vicinity in Dallas. But there's one star in it, and her name is Eula Weaver. And I want you to watch and listen. And I know you'll have a tendency to laugh when you see you, but I want you to listen carefully to everything Eula has to say, because she really has a real testimony. But we'll show the film now, and then
Millie, you've already heard her, and you've seen her on the film, and the reason you are here is because you came to hear her. She is a fantastic Christian mother, wife, and woman. This is her book, Aerobics for Women. She is presently co-authoring a book with Martha Fanning. And the title of it will be What Every Woman Still Knows. It's to come out next summer, I believe. Which will be, well, I'll let her tell you about what the book will be. I'm sure she can sell it a lot better than I can. I won't take any more time because I know she has so much to tell us. But first I want Mary Beth to come sing for us just one more time.
Here's someone with a lovely voice like that. I had to think about what the kindergarten teacher told me, and it's the honest to goodness truth. She said, in kindergarten, she said, honey, why don't you just hum? And I really have been humming all my life. But I want to thank you all for coming today. I just have so much I want to tell you. As a minister, you'll appreciate this. We always go to Dr. Chris. We go to First Church in Dallas, and we go to the early service because we know that he has to stop at 9:30 so we can go to Sunday school. Well, I feel like I'm at the 12 o'clock service. You know, you can just go on. The only hope you have is that I have to catch a plane in Oklahoma City at 4:50. So you know I'm not going to keep you too long. But I wanted to just briefly, and as I can, still tell you as much as possible, a few things today. I want to give two testimonies. I want to give one on physical fitness and one on spiritual fitness. And of course, I always start with the least important one first, which, as you know, is physical fitness. And just for the fun of it today, I want to see a show of hands. And let me finish the entire question before you hold up your hand. A show of hands of all of you that are involved in a regular aerobic type conditioning program. Now, by this, I mean that you are walking and don't ever play down walking. It's just as good as running, cycling, swimming, anything else. It just takes more time. You're walking, cycling, or swimming, or playing tennis, no doubles. One of these, or stationary running, one of these activities 4 to 5 times a week. Can I see a show of hands? I do this to see how hostile my audience is going to be, and I'm glad I'm in a church today. Because we don't have too many, but a few of you. But when you start to talk about exercise, the very first thing you have to do is to define what you mean by being physically fit. Because physical fitness means different things to different people. Many times to men, it means large bulging muscles. Unfortunately, too often, to young ladies, or women in general, it means a Miss America type figure. Well, how you look on the outside is not the best indicator of what kind of true physical condition you're in. When you realize that exercise can be used for rest and relaxation, which if you go out and ride for 18 holes on a golf cart, you've used it, and you come back and you say, gosh, I just feel fantastic. Well, probably you do, but you see, you've used exercise for relieving mental fatigue. Don't deceive yourself into thinking if you've been riding on a golf cart that you've done anything for your heart. Secondly, exercise, and it hit a lot of people, I can tell. Secondly, exercise can be used for figure contour. And I have nothing to say against the health spas. I mean, for taking off inches, firming up muscles, for what they're doing, fine and good. But don't think that calisthenics and figure contouring alone will do anything for your heart. We're interested in the third way exercise can be used, which is cardiovascular pulmonary fitness. And that's just medical terminology for your heart, your blood vessels, and your lungs. Because, ladies, you can get along without an attractive shape, but you can't get along without a good heart. And I want to briefly today tell you something about the aerobic exercises, why we feel these are the best exercises for building up the cardiovascular system. Most people will agree, most exercise physiologists will agree, that exercise can be divided into at least four broad categories. And the first ones you hear so much about are the isometric exercises. They were really the rage a few years ago. You know, you look in the mirror and make a face and tighten up muscles. It's the contraction of a muscle without movement of a joint. As I stand here, if I press on this podium, I'm contracting my muscle, but I'm not moving a joint. And about the only thing that's going to get you in condition for is perhaps more pressing down on podiums. I'm not a minister, but it is not going to do anything for your heart, lungs, and blood vessels. That's why we rule out isometric exercises. The second large group are the isotonic exercises. Now, there's the contraction of a muscle, but there's movement of a joint. This is where calisthenics fit in, like with Jack LaLanne on television, or calisthenics in general. Weightlifting is a good example. To give you a better example, it's kind of like when you just do isotonic exercises alone. It's kind of like giving a car a new coat of paint when what it really needs is an engine overhaul. It doesn't matter how jazzy it looks on the outside. If it doesn't have a motor in it, it's not going to go anyplace. So we're not interested necessarily in grooming the outside. We're interested in grooming the muscles on the inside, the ones that you need to keep you going. Thirdly, the anaerobic exercises. Now, these are getting close to what we feel are the best exercises because they demand large amounts of oxygen. It's like running the 100-yard dash. It's stop-start type activity. You get that old heart to pounding, but the problem is you don't sustain it long enough. It's stop-start type activity. I remember this one lady wrote us and said, "Dr. Cooper, I want you to know that I'm an avid horsewoman." She said, "I ride 2 hours every day." And she said, "I'd like to know how many points I get for that." The aerobic system is based on a point chart. You expend so much energy, you get so many points for that. He wrote back and he said, "Well, ma'am, you don't get any, but the horse gets a bunch." That's the way. You've got to put a little effort into it. And, you know, this brings us to the last type, the type I want to talk about briefly, and these are the aerobic exercises. I don't know, for those of you, I'll just throw this in, it might be of interest to you. I'm from Noble, Oklahoma, which is over near Norman, many of you may know, with the University of Oklahoma. My husband grew up in Oklahoma City, went to Putnam City. We both went to OU, and his first book was published in 1968 in Reader's Digest called How to Feel Fit at Any Age. And then his second book came out, The New Aerobics, and it was condensed in Reader's Digest called The Key to Fitness at Any Age. And then we co-authored Aerobics for Women, which was condensed in McCall's called Is Aerobics Fit for a Lady? And we've really had a tremendous response to the books. The books have been translated into 23 foreign languages and have been probably sold 8 million copies. And the only reason I'm giving you this information is I want you to know this isn't some gimmicky exercise program that my husband threw together overnight. It represents about 10 years of scientific work. Aerobics, however, has probably been more mispronounced than any word you can imagine. But I think it's A-E-R-O-B-I-C-S, aerobics. My husband did not make up the word. It comes out of the dictionary and means literally with air or with oxygen. But I think one of the most interesting examples of being misunderstood, I was invited to speak to one of the oldest social clubs in Dallas. And when I arrived, most of the ladies were in their 80s. And I heard this one turn to the other one and say, "What's this young woman going to speak to us about today?" And the other one said, "I think acrobatics." And I thought, well, I probably have as much luck with acrobatics as aerobics. But you know, much to my surprise, that was one of the most attentive, responsive, receptive groups that I've ever had the privilege to speak to. Because you see, ladies, I've seen tired, worn-out looking old women in their 20s. I see it when I go to high schools, girls 16 and 17, overweight, inactive, smoking cigarettes. And I have seen some of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life in their 60s and 70s. Because, you see, beauty is not skin deep. There's a radiance and glow in the face of people who stay physically active. There's one age, well, I shouldn't say what her age is, but there's one lady I met here today, and I know, even though I've never seen this woman before in my life, that she has to have been one of the ladies who stayed active over the years. The radiance and the glow in her face, the one who's getting ready to go to Hong Kong last year. I'm sure many of you know her. But, you know, I think one of the best examples I saw of this is my husband and I started the first Miles for Children walk for the March of Dimes in 1969 in San Antonio, Texas. At that time, it was a 40-mile walk. And I walked for 12 hours for charity, 40 miles. I started at 8 in the morning and finished at 8 in the evening. And I was in my early 30s. But do you know a 71-year-old lady walked every step of the way with me? A lot of people exist to 90, but they never really live past 20. And boy, the group I hit the very hardest is the AARP group, the American Association of Retired Personnel. Because I tell them, you know, here you are, you're to a point where you should be enjoying life, you're retired now, and so many of them have done nothing to keep their bodies physically fit. You'll see people in nursing homes in their late 50s simply because they have not used their body. It vegetates. The heart is a muscle. You don't use it, and you're going to lose it. It's just as simple as that. You take a good, strong, healthy arm, put it in a sling, and you don't use it, and what happens? The muscle dies. We are so inactive in this country. The attitude in this country is, if it moves, put a motor on it. From toothbrushes to remote controls on our television. Well, I'm not going to take time to go into the technical details of how the aerobics program was developed. My husband was a flight surgeon in the Air Force at San Antonio, and it is a very scientifically sound conditioning program, but you have to get a lot into physiology, so just take my word for it. It's scientifically valid. But there's some benefits that you can expect to receive if you're faithful 4 to 5 times a week, and you know you'll never have a successful exercise program unless you regiment it into your lifestyle. The person probably who's in most danger is the person who does nothing except on the weekend. The executive who sits in his office and then goes out and plays a hard game of tennis or handball on the weekend. You keep that heart doing nothing and then wham, you hit it. You know where we lose so many of our men? Hunting in Colorado. Not from gunshots. From the fact they should not be deer hunting, they should not be skiing when they've done nothing all year long to prepare themselves for it. But you know, there's some benefits that you can expect to receive if you're faithful to your program. And I asked for a show of hands a while ago of all the people who could find time to exercise. Very few hands went up. If I asked for a show of hands of everyone who found time to brush their teeth today, every hand would have gone up out of sheer embarrassment, if nothing else. You wouldn't want anyone to know you didn't brush your teeth. But ladies, you can live without your teeth, as many of you may be doing now. But you can't live without a good heart. And so my father-in-law was a periodontist in Oklahoma City for about 45 years, and he said, Millie, can't you find a better example than that? But you know one of the first things you're going to notice once you become involved in a regular exercise program? You'll notice that you breathe easier. Most of us just breathe out of about the top half of our lungs. And if we have to physically exert ourselves, and I mean by just going up 3 or 4 steps, we're huffing and we're puffing. Young people, just as badly as old people. And you know, there's actually a medical condition known as a sticky lung syndrome. In other words, we don't use our air, we don't use our lungs, we don't exert ourselves enough to force the air down into the lower part of our lungs. And it's like one of your children's balloons around the house as it starts to lose air. And you know how they get flabby? And when you actually try to exert yourself and force air down into that lung, many times you feel like you're having a heart attack and you think you've got chest pain. And it's just really a sign many times of just complete lack of doing nothing. But you may say, I breathe all right the way it is. But a lot of people don't. Emphysema and chronic lung disease is a real problem in this country. And let me hasten to say that I'm not standing up here saying that if you exercise, it's going to cure emphysema. But I am saying that emphysema and chronic lung problems, this is one area that they're beginning to use exercise as a therapeutic tool in working with many of these conditions. I know my husband had a young man in San Antonio as a patient who had emphysema so badly he couldn't walk across a room like this without stopping once or twice to breathe. He said, Dr. Cooper, I spend every waking moment just trying to breathe. And he said, life isn't worth living like this. And he said, do you think an exercise program will help you? And my husband said, I doubt it, but if you feel like that, we can try. Well, they started out with a young man, and he would walk feet and yards and blocks. And finally, he got to the point where it took him 2 years, but he could walk 1.5 miles in 30 minutes. Now, that's not very fast for most of us. But it opened up a whole new world to that man. He could play with the children without becoming completely exhausted. And speaking of children, we have studies going with asthmatic children in our research center in Dallas. Some of these asthmatic kids, they've had to miss a lot of school due to wheezing attacks. They're overweight. They're inactive. And just to see some of these kids who couldn't even go a few blocks without a wheezing attack work up to the point that they could go a mile and a half without a wheezing attack. That's exciting to me, ladies, to just see how exercise can be used in helping young lives like that. Another benefit you can expect to receive is that your blood vessels enlarge. Now, there's lots of controversy among the physicians as to whether exercise will keep you from having a heart attack. I cannot tell you that if you exercise, you're not going to have a heart attack. But I can tell you this. According to the data, not just my husband's, but data throughout the world, if you're exercising faithfully 4 to 5 times a week in an aerobic-type conditioning program, walking, cycling, running, one of these exercises, 4 to 5 times a week, and you have a coronary or a heart attack, your chances of surviving it are 5 times greater than the individual who's been doing nothing. Your chances in the preceding weeks where there's another great loss is better. And you know, doctors, as I said, some doctors feel like when you walk and exercise, you're building up new little vessels. In case you have an occlusion in one of those vessels, you've got new little vessels, new vascularity. Other physicians don't feel this is happening. But let me ask you this. How many people do you know that if they have a heart attack and they survive it, do you know what the doctor has them do the very first thing that they're able? You know. He puts them on a walking program. How many physicians do you know put their patient on an exercise program before they had that problem? The American Health Foundation made this statement in the New York Times. Ours is the legacy of a medical system that meets the patient with too much care too late. It's just like I tell people in Dallas, Baylor may have one of the finest coronary care units in the country, but if you don't make it there, what does it matter? But you know, I like a statement. And then people always give you the argument, well, I don't really have the time. I like the statement that I think it's Dr. Paul W. White said, walk your dog whether you have one or not. I think that's good advice. But I'm not talking about that kind of vascularity. I'm talking about varicose veins. You know, this is oversimplified, but essentially what happens when you have varicosities or varicose veins is the vein loses its elasticity and the blood pools down in there, making that dark, ugly spot on your leg or wherever. Well, there's nothing in the scientific literature to document that exercise will help varicose veins. But we've received hundreds of letters, and I mean hundreds, from people stating, men and women, that once they became involved in just a walking program, that many times their varicose veins tend to improve. My husband feels that perhaps what happens is that you build back up the integrity, the strength of that vessel, and that's why they do tend to improve. Another benefit you can expect to receive, and you know you're going to receive these. It's not like some of these soaps that you see on television and you wash your face with this and you'll look like Elizabeth Taylor tomorrow. I mean, you get all kinds of false promises from television. These are scientifically documented things that occur if you're just faithful and disciplined enough to exercise 15 to 20 minutes 4 times a week. Another benefit that you can expect is that your heart is going to become a more efficient pump. Now, I have to say in my behalf in the film that I didn't start for a very noble reason into my exercise program, and I said that it took me a year before I could run a mile nonstop. But I would like to say this, that I had a little slight handicap. I was pushing our little daughter in a stroller, who was about 3 at the time, and pulling a fat blonde cocker spaniel on a leash behind me. And we must have looked aside as we went up and down the hills with her red hair waving in the breeze and this fat dog coming along. But I did persist, and at the end of that year, 2 marvelous things had occurred. One terrible thing, and this is the truth, the dog died. And we strongly suspected a heart attack, but we couldn't let the rumor out. Dr. Cooper couldn't even keep his dog alive. So he said old age. But the marvelous thing that occurred, 2 marvelous things that occurred. First of all, to my husband, who is a scientist through and through. As a matter of fact, I was sharing with, I think, the ladies, he was in an emergency situation with another doctor on an Eastern flight the other day. They had to make an emergency landing. And they were all down in the emergency position to land, and this one doctor leaned on my husband. He said, "What's your heart rate?" And I said, "I don't know." And here they're going down, taking each other's heart rate. I said, "You've got to be a scientist, Ted. Just think about your pulse rate at a time like that." But anyway, the two marvelous things that occurred to my husband, which was exciting, that I had brought my resting heart rate from 80 beats a minute to 57 beats a minute. Now, let me explain to you what I'm talking about. Don't do it now, but when you get home, if you're not in condition, in other words, if you've not been exercising regularly, you will probably, your heart rate will probably be 80 to 100 beats per minute. If you've been exercising regularly, it will be much lower. Now, don't go home and say, "Well, I haven't been doing anything, and I still have a low resting heart rate." That could be indicative of a disease talk. I'm not saying it is, but I'm just saying don't feel, it's not important if you have a low resting heart rate, if it's not in response to an exercise program as far as cardiovascular protection is concerned. But he said, here was your heart, Millie, when you were not in condition, beating 80 beats a minute, wasting all that energy. And he said, then you got in condition, and it slowed down. It became a stronger, more effective pump, pumping out more blood with each stroke. Well, I was glad that that excited him, and it was nice to know that my heart was beating better. But I can tell you, ladies, I'm just as vain as the rest of you. And the thing that excited me was the fact that I had dropped two dress sizes. I had always been a size 8 at the top, but a size 12 at the bottom. And for the first time in my life, I could wear the same size dress all the way down. I really didn't lose that much weight, but I took about 4 inches off of my hips. And that's what you will notice once you get in a walking program. Even if you aren't dieting, you will notice inches coming off in the right places. But, you know, I'll tell you a little bit later on why losing those two dress sizes meant more to me than just vanity's sake. But another benefit you can expect to receive is that regular activity helps the digestive system. We have a friend who owns some nursing homes here in Oklahoma, and he has found that if he can get these elderly people out just to take a daily walk around the grounds of the nursing home, that in many cases, this helps regulate the problem of constipation. And you say, well, that's not serious. It can be very serious, and it can affect other systems in the body. But without doubt, people who exercise regularly have less problems with indigestion. Another benefit you can expect to receive is that you will sleep better. A lot of people suffer from insomnia. I'm amazed at the mail we get about people who can't sleep at night. And some people say if they take their walk or they exercise at the close of the day, it relaxes them and they go right to bed and sleep like a log. Other people say if they exercise at the close of the day, it keys them up and they can't get to sleep. The time of the day you exercise is an individual thing, which is up to you. I personally am a morning exerciser. And I will say this, the attrition rate, the dropout rate, is much greater in the people who exercise in the evening than the people who exercise in the morning. For somehow or other, if you get up and do it first thing in the morning, you won't find any excuse as to why you can't do it. And you know, people say, I run early in the morning, and they'll say, well, do you have to get to bed early at night? And I said, no, because you see, some people can sleep 12 hours every night and be totally exhausted the next day. Some people can sleep 6 hours and be a go-getter. You see, it's not the number of hours, it's not the quantity of hours, it's the quality of the sleep. And when you're physically active, you rest better at night. It's just as simple as that. And lastly, one of the benefits you can expect to receive if you're involved in a regular exercise program is that you become less of a hypochondriac. You know, I don't know that you don't have as many headaches, sore throats, just general aches and pains, but you bring a new attitude to them. You feel better, you look better, your self-image is improved. And I don't know, maybe it's like my husband used to come in and I'd say, oh, I have a terrible headache. And he'd say, well, why don't you go out and jog a mile? You know, just what I wanted to hear, of course. And sometimes I would, and I'd come back and he'd say, how's your headache? And I said, who knows? I hurt so bad everywhere else. But maybe it's just forgetting about it. But these benefits, all of these things that I have mentioned, are collectively known as the training response or the training effect. And you're going to receive them. And if you're faithful to your program long enough to taste the training effect, like Eula Weaver in the movie, wasn't she a remarkable example, 87 years of age? Once you've tasted the exhilaration that comes from feeling good, and if you're tired at 10 o'clock in the morning, unless you've had a pretty rough night the night before, there's something wrong. People should be living the day, not dragging through it. And that's what I want to encourage you today to do, is to live, not just exist. I don't care what your age. Age is no factor. But you know, there's a real problem that we're having in this country. It's the major cause of death. And it's increasing in women just alarmingly fast. Do you know what that is? Heart disease. We are in an epidemic stage of heart disease in this country. Let me give you an example. The American male, 21 years of age, in 1950 ranked 11th in longevity among the major nations of the world. In 1970, 20 years later, he ranked 41st. One of the most affluent countries in the world, and we're killing off our young people just by the fact that they aren't doing anything to take care of themselves. You know, let me read you a little article here. It says out of the New York Times that since 1950, there has been a 14% increase in deaths from heart attacks. Now listen, not in old men, in men 25 to 44 years of age. It's not possible to be in a group of 10 people unless someone has lost a loved one or has had personally have had some contact with heart disease. And ladies, it's not a problem of just the men. Let me read you an article I cut out of the Dallas Times Herald, and this was as far back as December 15, 1971, entitled Heart Attacks Taking a Toll Among Women. Women are beginning to be as vulnerable to heart attacks as men, according to a Denver cardiologist. Women in the past were always presumed to be protected from heart attacks during their premenopausal years. It used to be until a woman had gone through the change of life, you didn't hear too much about her having heart attacks. That's not true anymore. He said, Dr. Kimball says, I hate to equate women's lib with this, but it would appear that women competing in a man's world are showing an earlier incidence of vascular problems. They're eating more, they're smoking more, and at the same time, they're increasing their stress situations, and more women under 40 are dying of strokes and heart attacks. It is not just a problem of the men. But do you know there's a triad that exists in this country, and if these factors exist in your life, your chances of having a heart attack are fantastically increased. I don't care if you're male or female. First of all, if you eat a high saturated fat diet, and you know what that is, the typical American diet. Secondly, if you're under a lot of stress, who isn't under stress? We zap our kids in school by the time they can toddle, and there's stress even in nursery school. Think about these. High saturated fat diet, stress, inactivity. As I said, the attitude in this country is if it moves, put a motor on it. And my goodness, you add two more factors onto that, and you're sitting on a keg of dynamite. You add the fact that you smoke cigarettes and that you come from a family that has heart disease in the family. You know, on that stress factor, I do want to mention this. There was a study conducted. I always give this to men's groups as a rule, and they never like it, but I always give this bit of data. There was a study conducted at Harvard University regarding the role that stress plays in heart disease. And this study showed that men who were unfaithful to their wives had a higher death rate from heart attacks than men who were faithful. I said, frankly, it's prison rot, in my opinion. But they were under so much stress and strain, afraid that they were going to get caught, that in many instances, it was enough to precipitate a heart attack. I was giving that to a Lions Club, I won't say in what city, not long ago, and this one little man in the back of the room held up his hand and he said, how high were those statistics again? I have you better think twice. But you know, if as intelligent human beings, someone tells you these are the known risk factors as far as heart disease is concerned. And those aren't the known risk factors according to Dr. Kenneth Cooper. I'm not giving you any biased research. Those are risk factors according to the American Heart Association, which is the best source we have at the present time on heart disease. All right? If someone told you those are the five major risks for heart disease, wouldn't you want to try to eliminate as many of those things out of your life as possible? That just makes sense. Look at it. Heredity, you can't do one single thing about. Stress, oh yes, yes. You play a very important role here. I spoke to a very influential group of women in a city not long ago, and I looked at them. They looked rather smug to me, I guess, and I just wanted to jar them out of their smugness, and because they said, I don't need that exercising debt. And I said, you know what? You're here today because your husband is working and affording you the opportunity of coming out well-groomed for a lovely luncheon. Do you realize tomorrow you may be out looking for a job if your husband has a heart attack? Because you see, heart disease is devastating. It's not many times they don't die when they have that heart attack. And the financial strain on the family, the emotional strain. And I tell these women, and the reason I make this point to them, is that it is essential, no matter if you think you look like Miss America, that you get out there and encourage your husband to be physically active, watch his diet, take as much stress out of his life as possible, because you're helping your own future, if you just want to look at it selfishly like that. But you know how most women get involved in an exercise program? Their husband has his first heart attack, and if he survives it, they start walking with him to keep him encouraged. And then they notice a change in their own lives. But as far as what I was saying about the stress, Dr. Fred Heinzelman with the U.S. Public Health Service did a study with college faculty professors, and he looked at the University of Wisconsin, Penn State, and University of Minnesota with 108 faculty professors. And he put these men's exercise groups. And he found if the wife had a positive attitude toward her husband's exercise program, that 80% of the men were faithful, had a good or excellent adherence pattern to the program. They were faithful to the program. If the wife had a neutral or negative attitude, only 40% of the men were faithful to their program. Ladies, you set the mood in the home. And if you're in a bad mood when your husband gets home, it won't take you 5 minutes to get him in one too. Try to make it conducive to life. Just by watching the fat intake into your family's diet and have a balanced meal. And my goodness, can you ever do anything about that other one? Cigarette smoking. I'm not here, ladies, to give a big harangue about cigarette smoking. If you smoke, you know the pros and cons. Just don't think that it's going to hit someone else and not you. As the overweight girl in the movie said, you got to face facts. Cigarette smoking causes cancer and heart disease. Now, you can deny that if you want to, but that's a fact. But I want to read you an article that I cut out of the Dallas Times Herald, out of Chicago, UPI. Smoking drive aimed at children. The American Cancer Society is so concerned about young people smoking that a special warning program has been started for kindergarten children. For a long time, Dr. Charles Westfall said we used to hit children later on, but we're finding out that fifth and sixth grade children have already picked up the smoking habit and they're using their lunch money to buy cigarettes. By the fifth grade, we found that half the students have tried smoking. You know what the greatest increase in cigarette smoking has been in this country? In girls 12 to 17. And you can't help but wonder as time goes on if the heart disease statistics won't even equal the men's and women's. As I said, I'm not here to talk to you personally, other than the fact, the effect that you might have on starting a young person, keeping a young person from starting into smoking cigarettes. This made me ill when I cut this out of paper the other day. Schools approve smoking areas. All but two senior high schools in the Dallas Independent School District have designated smoking areas on campus. The survey made at the request of the school board also revealed that three Dallas Independent School District junior high schools have designated smoking areas. Those little old kids are 11, 12 years of age. You know, I could go on and on, and I'm only throwing this out to you because I want you to know the data that exists on cigarette smoking and heart disease. Cigarette smoking cuts the female lifespan. Heavy cigarette smoking among women is blamed for a marked increase in sudden death from coronary heart disease. Listen, the new study shows that heavy cigarette smoking may cut a woman's lifespan by as much as 19 years. The mean age for females dying of sudden heart attacks is 67 years of age among non-smokers, 55 years of age among light smokers, and 48 years of age among heavy smokers. Is it worth it? I don't think so. You know, you always hear these people who say, though, well, my smoking doesn't really affect anyone but me. Doesn't it? This article says non-smokers are learning to defend themselves. This little study was made that a research team at Wayne State University in Detroit found that acute illnesses, mostly respiratory, were twice as prevalent among young children whose parents smoked at home than among those whose parents never smoked in the home. Recent experiments at Texas A&M University and elsewhere indicate that even 30 minutes in a smoke-filled environment significantly increases the non-smoker's heart rate, his blood pressure, and the amount of carbon monoxide in his blood. If you suffer from allergies and sinuses and things such as I do, you become very sensitive to cigarette smoke, and when you're on a long, long flight, it can be very annoying. There have been some signs around Dallas that I've seen. They're crude, but I rather like them because they get the point across. It says, you smoke, and I chew. You don't blow smoke on me, and I won't spit on you. Because you see, if someone spits on you, you can tissue it off. But if they blow nicotine into your lungs, you don't tissue that off. But you know, if you smokers think that I've been hard on you, and you're sensitive, I can assure you there's a group that's far more sensitive than you smokers. And that's a group that, this group, 50 million of them, suffer from it. And you all know what it is. Obesity. 25% of the American population are at least 15 pounds overweight. When I get to this point in my presentation, I always feel like the preacher said he's already quit preaching and gone to meddling now. But you know, I have the right to stand up here and talk to you about obesity because I happen to come from a very fat family. I'm 42 years of age, and my sister Alice was only 6 years old. 3 years ago, weighed 242.5 pounds. My grandmother died weighing close to 300 pounds. I know the psychology of fat people, and I can assure you they are not happy people. I don't care how pretty their face is or how much they smile. I don't mean 5, 10, 15, 20 pounds overweight. I mean excessively overweight. It saps their energy, their self-confidence. Let me give you an example of Alice, my sister. For those of you who read my book, excuse me, because this story is in the book, but I want to repeat it. Alice is a nurse, and I know she has varicose veins so badly, and her legs were so large, she had weeping varicosities, where you could put your hand up and feel the moisture coming from the varicose veins. You can't even do surgery safely on someone that overweight because of the danger of the anesthesia. Well, make a long story short, we were there at Christmas, and my husband, at this particular Christmas, not this one, but he said, Alice, you are going to lose that leg. He said, go in there and weigh. And she said, but Ken, I've just eaten. Now, at 242, what was that play still matters? Well, as I said, to make a long story short, Alice got into a good dietary restrictive program. She started stationary cycling, and she started walking. And she got down to about 190 pounds, and she just looked great. And our only problem with her was to convince her she had a little bit further to go. And I'd like to say that by now, Alice is a nice 140 or 50 or something. But you see, life isn't like that. It's like you smokers who quit for 5 weeks, 5 years, 10 years, and something triggers you, and you start back. In Alice's case, her daughter Debbie got a divorce, and we'd never had a divorce in our family, and it was hard on all of us. But it was particularly hard on Alice, and you know exactly what she did. She started eating. She called me a year ago, and she said, Millie, don't tell Ken, I hate him. She doesn't, but my husband is a very disciplined man. For those of you who heard him speak, you can believe this, can't you? Here is the problem. Here is the answer. Do it. Most physicians are that way. Until you see one overweight, smoking a cigarette, telling other people not to do those things. If my husband walked in here waddling with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, how much effect is he going to have on you as to the value of practicing preventive medicine? And ladies, that's what it is. Preventive medicine when you exercise. But as I said, she said, don't tell Ken, but I weigh 247.5 pounds. And she said, I don't know what to do. And I said, she said, I told him at the hospital that you have everybody in Dallas praying for me. And I said, well, that's the only thing to do, Alice. But she told me the other day that she got back into a good, she's going to Weight Watchers. Now, I don't know anything about Weight Watchers, but for her, her personality, it's working. And she's walking again. And I think she's down around 200. And I do solicit your prayers for Alice because I want her to know what it's like to feel good. Let me give you an example of her attitude. We were at my parents' home in Noble, and they have a little clock that someone had given them, a little novelty clock with a little boy and girl in a swing. And as the clock ticks, the little swing goes back and forth. And Alice said, you know, I despise that clock. And I said, well, why, Alice? And she said, because they look so happy. And I don't understand people who look happy all the time. Well, I think she's going to know what it's like, and I do solicit your prayers for her. But I don't want to make you any false promises. If you get it, there is no exercise program that's going to make you lose large amounts of weight unless you diet along with it. What happens, though, if you just start doing an exercise program, let me start over. If you fast and you aren't exercising along with it, you're just dieting, you get weak. You know what? You're burning up about 50% fat, but you're burning up about 50% of your muscle mass. Whereas if you combined a diet with an exercise program, then you're burning up 100% fat. Have any of you been to our center in Dallas? You have, huh? You've seen the tank that I'm going to tell them about. I'd like to extend an invitation to any of you who happen to be in Dallas. We're just 3/4 of a mile south of the Valley View Shopping Center on Preston Road, to stop by and see our facility. But we have a tank there, and it's called a total body volume meter. It's based on the Archimedes principle, the displacement of water. Men stand on this little elevator, and they're lowered into this tank of water nude. The ladies are allowed to wear bikinis because we don't have we have male technicians. But anyway, what this does is tell you exactly what your ideal weight should be based on you. It tells you how much of your body is fat and how much is muscle, and what your ideal weight is for you. And you, ladies, you can't use the excuse I've been using for years, that I've got big bones. I always tell my husband, that's just because I've got big bones, because, you know, it calls a spade a spade. But I don't care. I could just go on and on and tell you all some of the benefits that occur from a regular exercise program. My father, 69 years of age, had hypertension, high blood pressure for years. Took off 35 pounds, stopped smoking about 2 packs of cigarettes a day, started walking 3 miles a day, and for the first time in his life, his blood pressure is perfectly normal without medication. My mother is another example. And you know, in most cases, when a patient comes in with hypertension, he could say to the doctor, you know, really, we can control your blood pressure without giving you any medication. You know, we can put you on a diet, and we can put you on a good exercise program, and we probably won't have to give you any medicine. Do you think the patient wants to hear that? Not on your life. That's hard when they can just take a pill and pop it in their mouth. But you see, we are so pill-oriented that we don't realize that even aspirin has side effects. And that we are so anxious to take the easy way out. And first of all, do you think the doctor's going to take the time to do that? Neither the patient or the doctor, and too often, will take the time to do that. But adult onset diabetes, many patients who've had... pass 40 years of age, gain weight, start passing sugar in your urine. Once they get involved in a good exercise program, the sugar is reduced. There's many medical conditions, if I had time to go into, which I don't, that respond well to an exercise program. But lastly, the thing I want to mention about the aspect of the physical part, I said I'm going to make my spiritual part shorter because the pastor can give you all the spiritual parts. But I do have a few words to say more. But the reason I exercise is not because of what Ken has convinced me that it does for my heart, or I know what it does for my figure. I know all those things. But I run because of what it does for me right up here. You see, you can document with personality profile testing a change in an individual's personality once they become involved in the conditioning program. They look better. They feel better. I'm a very hyper person, and I'm not going to live my life on tranquilizers. Do you realize that the most widely sold medication in America today is Valium? Young mothers in the area where I live, and all over Dallas, in some of the affluent areas of down any level, get their kids off to school in the morning, and the first thing they do is take the first Valium of the day. Well, exercise is my tranquilizer, with good side effects, not bad side effects. I run with a group, you saw the girls at the beginning of the film. I run with a group of girls in the morning at about 5:30. And I, let me hasten to tell you, you don't have to run, you can walk. Walking's beautiful. I happen to run because I like to get it over with rapidly. But I get up and join these women at 8 o'clock. I told my husband, it's like sticking your finger in your eye. It feels so good when you stop. And I love the benefits that I get from it, but I can't truthfully say that I like the running part. But I join these ladies, and there are about 8 of us, and we're all 40 years or older probably, And we run, well, 4 miles usually, but we started out, of course, much less than that. Don't let me discourage you by distance. This, it doesn't matter. A mile is sufficient, unless if you're going to go faster. If you're going to want to go slower, then you may have to go longer distance. But we run in the morning, and I wish you could see the changes in the lives of some of these girls. I remember this one, a former airline stewardess, overweight, cigarette smoking, heavily, 2 packs a day, seeing a psychiatrist twice a week, and now... I'm not saying exercise is a panacea, but I wish you could see her particularly. She's down to 110 pounds. She still smokes, but not as much. She sees a psychiatrist about once a month. We tease her that we're going to start charging her fees because in the morning we talk about everything. And it is delightful, and I love it. And I get up, and I don't, as I said, like the exercise, but I love the social contact. And there's no reason in the world why you ladies. I met a nice lady here who just moved here who was telling me that she walked, but she really didn't have anyone to walk with. Where did I see you sitting over at this table? I want to find a walking partner from you. The one that moved, yeah, in the red shirt back here. Right here, you're looking the other way with your hand on your head. You. I'm trying to find a walking partner for her because I was telling her that, you know, there's no reason why you can't find a friend to walk with you and make it enjoyable. And boy, if you get to talking, you don't even realize how much time has passed. But, you know, I come back in the morning and I fix my husband's breakfast, and I used to package lunch, now I eat some bowl of soup at the center. But I get him off to work at about 6:45, and I have about 45 minutes quiet time before the children get up. Now, I don't know what the others do, but for me personally, this is when I have my Bible study time. Because by 8 o'clock in the morning, I have prepared myself to the very best of my ability, both physically and spiritually. And you know, we are spiritual as well as physical. And I don't care how physically fit you get. If you aren't spiritually fit as well, there'll be an emptiness in your life. And I like to call my presentation the joy of living. Because I'm not going to say that nothing's going to happen to me then that day that'll be discouraging, but I challenge you to start a day prepared in those two areas. It's altogether different. And you know, I don't want to imply that I have a great spiritual strength, because I want you to hear just how much I have grown, though, and it might give hope to some of you who haven't grown as much yet. But I grew up, as I said, in Noble. My parents didn't go to church regularly. They always sent my two sisters and I. And it's not the same. It's when you don't go with your children. But we moved. I didn't worry about it too much because, you see, and ordinarily when I say this, I'm not speaking in a small town. But the little small town I grew up in, I was a good girl. And being a good girl in the little town I grew up in meant that you didn't drink, smoke, or have sex before you were married. And unfortunately, moral goodness I equated with salvation, I suppose, because I didn't worry about much about knowing the Lord. I was a good girl. I thought that was sufficient. I went to the University of Oklahoma and lived at home all 4 years I was in school. And my mother saw that I still got up and went to church regularly, but I wasn't too concerned about it because I knew I was still morally good. And then I graduated and I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, to work as a recreation director at Fort Sill. And if my church going had been bad at home, I guarantee you it went to pot when I got out on my own. Because I worked from 1 in the afternoon till about 10 at night, many times on Sunday. And I wasn't too worried about going to church, though, because I was still morally good. I just couldn't see that anything else was necessary. But you know, the Lord has a plan for us all. And the first step in His plan with me came in the form of a young flight surgeon named Ken Cooper. Now, Ken had known the Lord, I think, all his life. He grew up in Oklahoma City. His grandfather was a Baptist preacher, and he had a wonderful Christian home. And at one time thought he would be a medical missionary, which is interesting. He is a medical missionary, but he's just not on a foreign field. And he has some marvelous opportunities to witness to some of these men who come through the center. But I know he was so opposite from me. And some of my friends, when they found out I was going with Ken, said, "Oh my goodness, Millie, surely you're not going to marry Ken Cooper. He's the dullest thing I've ever seen." Said, "And if you do, you'll probably spend the rest of your New Year's Eves in a church basement somewhere." My friend, that was a fate worse than death. I must say, I spent a few New Year's Eves there, too, and had a great time. But, you know, I guess love conquers all, because I married him. And I want to tell you something, my church going picked up. I found out that people not only went to church on Sunday morning, but they went to church on Sunday night and even on Wednesday night. I won't tell you what denomination I grew up in. I think they had services then too. I just never checked. But Ken was very, very wise. He never said, "Now, Millie, you are going to church with me." He was very wise. He just said, "Honey, I'm going to church tonight, and I'd just love for you to come go with me." Not, "I'm going." Now, I mean, you know, you can stay home if you want to, but I'm going. Well, I'd go with him, you know, and I can remember one of the things that shocked me so is when he reached over and took hold of my hand in church, and I thought, "Oh, my goodness, somebody will see this." I just had never thought about holding hands with a person you love in church. Isn't that funny how we get these prudish ideas that God didn't want us to touch each other in His presence? But that encouraged me a lot. I thought, well, maybe they aren't so straight-laced. So I started going to church with him, and I remember, and we didn't say grace at our home, and he would always, at every meal, say, "Millie, would you like to say grace tonight?" And I'd say, "No, Ken, you know I don't want to. Now, if you want to say it, say it. I just don't have anything to say." I'd never prayed publicly before in my life. So we were married for about 9 months, and we moved to San Antonio, Texas. The next thing was coming up. And I remember we got into a Sunday school class down. I got into a Sunday school class down there, and the teacher asked me to dismiss the class. I went into a state of shock. I have no idea what I said. But when I got out, I said, Kendall, did you ever ask me to come to this church again? I said, I can't even imagine a church where they ask you to pray out loud. I said, I don't know what I said, but I'm sure I ended it. And bless this food to the nourishment of your body. Have you ever noticed how Baptists always use that expression? Being one of you now, I can say that. I still don't know if I said that. But about that time, our first wedding anniversary came along. Well, I expected fully. I thought surely some romantic something like a diamond drop or gold bracelet or something romantic. You know what I got, don't you? A Bible. And I'm not proud of this next part. But you know what I did with it? And the only reason I can tell you is because I'm not that old Millie anymore. I'm a new person. But I threw it at him. And it lay on the floor 2 days before I picked it up. And you know, I think it was the first Bible I'd ever owned, my very own. But I picked it up and I read what he had written in it. August the 7th, 1960, to my wonderful wife on our very first wedding anniversary. May you remember this gift as a symbol of our love and as the strength it gives to our relationship with our Lord, with a love surpassed only by His love. Kid. You think that touched me? Not yet. But I moved into a Sunday school class. I don't want to stop here and tell you something. I think about what a difference a Sunday school teacher can make. You know, you heard the song, What a Difference a Day Makes. What a difference a teacher can make. Don't you ever take the responsibility of teaching a Sunday school class unless you feel committed to it. Don't you ever try to tell somebody about God if you don't know Him personally. I had learned to speak the language. I knew how to blend right in that Baptist church down there. I knew just what they all said to each other. But I didn't know the Lord. And don't think because you've been sitting in a Sunday school class with somebody for 10, 15, maybe 40 years, gray hair doesn't make you saintly. A lot of people don't know God who has gray hair. Age does not make you know God. But you know, I met a Sunday school teacher, and her name was Lonzalee Brown. And oh, how she knew me. She couldn't talk about him unless tears came in her eyes. And you know, she used to kind of make me uncomfortable because I just didn't really like that kind of emotionalism. But the radiance she had when she taught those lessons. And she told me later, she said, you know, Millie, when you came into that class, she said, I looked at you and I saw the indifference in your face. Not disbelief, ladies, indifference, which is even worse. Because you have something to hide behind. And she said, I pray, Lord, help me win this young girl to you, because I know that she can be a great servant for you. And you know, as I sat in Mrs. Browning's Sunday school classes Sunday after Sunday, she told me, she said, at first, Millie, I could see your mind that just clicking along, thinking, oh, I hope this will hurry up and be over. I got to check on dinner. How many of you are like that? But anyway, we were studying in John, Nicodemus. And I thought, you know, Millie, you're really like Nicodemus. You've achieved a certain goal in life where you can get pretty much anything material that you want by layaway or hook or crook or some way. But you don't really have that inner radiance and happiness and peace that you see in Mrs. Browning's face and in Ken's face. And I sat there in that class that day, and no one knew it but me. And I said, Lord, I don't know if I've ever asked you to come into my life or not. But if I haven't, I'm asking you today, Lord, to come into my life, to be my personal Savior, and to guide me and direct me, and help me to have the inner peace and happiness that Mrs. Browning and Ken has. Well, I didn't say anything to anyone, and I went home after church. We were in the bedroom changing clothes, and I said, Ken, you know what? I was born again today. And he came over, and he put his arms around me, and he said, Millie, I've been waiting 7 years to hear you say that. And you know, I didn't even know what born again meant. But I just knew something new had happened inside of me. And so we were both crying, of course, and my little three-year-old daughter came up and she said, "Daddy, why is Mommy crying?" And he said, "Honey, because she's so happy." Have you ever tried to tell a three-year-old that you cry when you're happy? But you know, I want to tell you, ladies, my face changed. It did. There was a softness about it that just hadn't been there before. And I wanted to go up to people who I knew didn't like me, and they had reason probably not to like me because I was a very self-centered person. I wanted things the way Millie wanted them. I just couldn't see too many other people's viewpoints. And I wanted to go up to these people and touch them and say, "Look at me. Don't hate me because I love you, and I'm sorry for the selfish, inconsiderate type person that I have been." And you know, particularly the singing touches my heart so much because I can't sing. And the Lord did not help me with that, even though He saved me. But I would go to church on Sunday, and I knew why Mrs. Browning cried. I knew why the tears ran down her cheeks when she sang those songs. And I looked around me, and I thought, they aren't even paying any attention to what they're singing. They aren't even listening. And when you think of the words of those songs, and I thought of how I loved my little son, my little daughter at that time, and I thought the thought of someone taking her out and driving a nail through her hand for people who didn't even care. And I looked around at those indifferent faces. Ladies, I want to tell you something. One of the worst things that's happening in our society is that we're becoming religious and non-Christians. Let me give you an example. I didn't mean to throw this in, but I'm going to, because it fits in very well. Martha Fanning is the wife of Buckner Fanning, this girl I'm writing, lady I'm writing the book with, and it's just a big hurrah for the Christian wife and mother is basically what it is. But we had been working for about 12 hours, and we were exhausted. And I had to go to the beauty shop, and was late. And as I was driving to the beauty shop, I thought, "Oh, Lord, I just wonder if this book really has a message. I just wonder if it really does have anything to say." And there's so many good Christian books out. And I was thinking this as I drove to the beauty shop, and I got in the beauty shop, and I sat down at the shampoo bowl, and I looked over at the lady sitting next to me. And I've never seen such a absolutely crushed expression on one face in my life. I didn't know her, but I just smiled at her. Do you know that's a witness sometimes? To smile at someone. And she said, and when I smiled, of course, she looked at me and she said, "I'm getting my hair fixed pretty," because she said, "I have to go tomorrow to end 33 years of my life." She says, "My 56-year-old husband is leaving me for his 38-year-old secretary." She said, "We have 5 children and 3 grandchildren." And she said, "I packed up and went home to Kentucky." And she said, "But you know I couldn't stay," because she said, "You can't go home again." That's the title of a chapter in our book. And I was so moved when she said that, I just reached over and I took hold of her hand. And I said, "I know tomorrow is going to be a very tough day in your life, and I want you to know I'm going to pray for you. I don't know why we're so reluctant to touch each other. And I'm not in all this bit of going around telling you about your problems and hanging on each other. But touching them with Christian love, just their hand. Do you realize how many people the most intimate contact they have with anyone in their entire life is talking to the man at the grocery store? They have no one to reach out and just touch them." But then she said a statement, and this is the reason I'm telling you the story. She said, "The secretary he's leaving me for, though, is a very religious woman. She's a Baptist, and she prayed God would send her a good husband. But she didn't know he'd be married." What we do in the name of religion. A very religious woman. Well, I'd like to tell you that after accepting Christ, that I never had any more problems. That I didn't want to. That I never tried to beat anyone out for a parking spot. That I wasn't rude when someone turned in front of me and I honked at him. Or at the grocery store. How discourteous we are to each other in the name of being Christians. We were talking about the lady who takes two parking places every Sunday to church because she doesn't want anyone to nick her car. And how she spends through the service. What kind of conscience, what a selfish attitude. But anyway, God knew that we were going to have to fight that old nature in us. And that's why I love what Paul says in the Living Bible in Romans 8, starting with the 5th verse, where he says, those who let themselves be controlled by their lower natures live only to please themselves. But those who follow after the Holy Spirit find themselves doing those things that please God. Following after the Holy Spirit leads to life and peace, but following after the old nature leads to death, because the old sinful nature within us is against God. It never did obey God's laws, and it never will. That's why those who are still under the control of their old sinful selves, bent on following their old evil desires, can never please God. But listen, but you're not like that. You are controlled by your new nature if you have the Spirit of God living in you. And remember that if anyone doesn't have the Spirit of Christ living in you, he's not a Christian at all. You know, I love that. I think Bill Bright, who did in Campus Crusade, I'm not sure who, but the Metamorphosis of the Butterfly, where he described the Christian experience like being like a butterfly. Here's this big, ugly, green worm. That one day it changes into this magnificent butterfly. Now, you know, that may be the loudest butterfly in the whole world. He may just flop around on the ground, fly into walls, never use those magnificent wings to fly and spread beauty and light on all those about him. But you know what? He's not ever going to be that ugly green worm again. Isn't that reassuring to you? To know that we don't use the marvelous opportunities we have to tell others about the Lord and to show